Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the LSE. My name is Gus O'Donnell. I work for the British Treasury in charge of macroeconomic policy and international finance. My previous job was as UK Executive Director to the IMF through the period that Stan talked about yesterday, for those of you who are here for yesterday's session, through the various crises. And I remember working very closely with Stan. He would be basically chairing many of the board sessions. You would find him one day in Indonesia negotiating a package. The next day he would be there chairing a board meeting and listening very earnestly and intently to the various suggestions put forward by executive directors like myself as to how he might have negotiated it slightly better. And Stan observed that skill, which I recommend to you as students at the LSE, of being able to listen intently and do lots of other work at the same time, as he managed to listen to the breaking news from Indonesia in terms of market, economic and political developments. When I overstepped the mark and ended up talking to Stan in his room, in his office in the IMF, I couldn't help but notice that he had there a bust of Keynes in his room, who you may know of as a We in the Treasury like to think of him as a very well-known former Treasury economist, but others look at it through some other lights. Keynes had one of these famous phrases that I love very much, and people have clearly got this quote completely wrong, because the bit they remember is, in the long run, we're all dead, which to my mind is a fairly uninformative soundbite. What Keynes then went on to say was, and I quote, "Economists set themselves too easy, too useless a task if in tempestuous seasons they can only tell us that when the storm is long past, the ocean will be flat again." Now, you have before you here the past master of managing storms, or crises as it were, and he has devoted his time in the fund, which he's talking about tonight, to how to manage and pilot economies through these storms. I've seen him do it, let me say that I am full of admiration for him. Indeed, for me, he is to economies in crisis what Sven-Goran Eriksson has been to the English football team. Yesterday you had from Stan the hors d'oeuvre. I am looking forward now to the entree, and as any good introducer should do, I shall shut up and pass you on to Stan, who will talk till about 7 o'clock and then is happy to take questions.
Thanks very much indeed, Gus. One of the nicest things that happened to me as I left the IMF was that I was given a copy of the bust of Keynes, so that will be one of the things that I'm happiest about having had to leave. Well, I didn't have to leave, but I left. We ended last time by taking a look at how deep were the recessions that hit the six economies we were discussing. And I want to go on and take a look at a few more of the major impacts on key variables of the recessions, and then go on and discuss the programs that were put in place and the controversies about them. And then I'll conclude with some reflections, including, as I mentioned at the end of last night, how would you do it differently, although that will how would you have done it differently, although that will come out as we keep talking. Well, what I'd first like to show is the change in the current account deficit that took place in the six crisis countries following the recessions. Remember, these are the Asian ones. Year T is the year that the crisis hits, and T plus one, etc. And then Brazil, Russia, and Mexico are different. Mexico less different than the others. What you had in the Asian, what you had in Mexico, was a in year T minus one, which is 1993, a 7% of GDP current account deficit. And that moved within 2 years to near balance. And turning a current account around by 6% of GDP is no small achievement. We thought it was some sort of record, and it probably was at the time. But then you have this unbelievable change in the Asian economies, in which Thailand, the one in green, in particular, goes from a recession of minus 8% of GDP in 1996 to a surplus of 11% of GDP. Actually, it was nearly 13 in 1998. In other words, the current account turned around by 20% of GDP within a period of 2 years, which surely is a record. And the Koreans, who had a 13% surplus, the gray country, did almost as well. And those massive current account surpluses were actually bringing in a lot of money. 10% of GDP, to be precise, was the inflow. So the dealing with debt problems is a lot easier if you have 10% of GDP coming in the form of a current account surplus. Russia, of course, has, that's the purple country, had a huge turnaround in the current account. It was essentially balanced before the crisis. And then with the help of what happened to oil and a very significant devaluation, but mainly oil, Russia got to the point of an 18% of GDP current account surplus. And as I sometimes tell Russians, you're very lucky you have all that capital flight, because you wouldn't know what to do with the 18% of GDP current account surplus otherwise. But that's only half serious. So there you have these tremendous turnarounds in the current account, with one exception, and that is Brazil, the less luminescent green in the lower picture, where the current account did almost nothing despite a 50% devaluation. And the failure of the current account of Brazil to respond is one of the mysteries and disappointments of these crises. Now, there's a bit, the trade account did actually improve, and it was the service account that deteriorated because interest payments on their foreign debt went up. So it's not quite as bad as it seems, but it is nonetheless very striking relative to the others. Well, what happened to the exchange rates corresponding to these movements in the current account? And here we have nominal exchange rates. I'm measuring them in what I think is the British way, which is upside down for Latin Americans, North Americans, and much of the rest of the world. There are 100 at on the day before the relevantly dated crisis devaluation begins. And what you see happening is overshooting in each case, even in the nominal rates, and then some coming back, except for the Indonesian case, where it sort of putters along at about the same level with a massive 75 to 80% devaluation in nominal terms, and then a very clear ranking of the non-Asian countries, with Brazil having nominally devalued the least, but still about 35%. Mexico about 45%, and this is the loss in the value of the currency, not the not its inverse. And then Russia had a huge nominal devaluation. But of course, the nominal devaluations are not the whole story. The real devaluations are more relevant, and they behave much more similarly, which is to tell you that the inflation rates obviously behave quite differently. You see that after some overshooting of every one of them, the real rate comes back, even in the Indonesian case, to a devaluation of over 20%. They're mostly 25%, 20 to 25%, with Thailand and Russia with Indonesia and Russia a bit more of a real devaluation after a year and a half. So the real effects, the real exchange rate effects are quite similar. you'd say there's nothing very exciting in that. That's all of what you expected. But there is something very interesting. Every single one of these countries before the crisis, they all told you that we're not overvalued by more than 10% to 15%. And that number is sort of just is always pronounced, they all ended up with bigger devaluations, but nothing like they were driven to in the early days of the crisis, when exchange rates overshot massively, particularly in real terms. The impacts on inflation were very, very different. You see that the Asians, aside from Indonesia, kept inflation strictly under control. On an annual basis, it never got itself, except in Indonesia, much above 7%. Indonesia, on the other hand, had a very high inflation in 1998. Russia also has high inflation following the devaluation, and that's consistent with what you saw before on the behavior of real and nominal exchange rates. Mexican inflation did reach over 40% in 1995 and didn't come down as fast as the others. And the big success was Brazil, which had feared that it would set off the inflations that it had had in previous decades, and in fact did not. And Brazil kept inflation remarkably under control. Well, let me turn now to the IMF programs or the IMF-supported programs and discuss some of the key issues, and I may not get to discuss all of them. As you all know, there was a huge outburst of storm of criticism about these programs. And the criticisms were first about fiscal policy, second about monetary and exchange rate policies, particularly the use of interest rates to defend the currencies. Thirdly, structural policies, particularly those relating to the financial sector. Fourth, the questions of private sector involvement and of the use of capital controls. It's an interrelated set of questions. Fifth, the size of the financing packages. And sixth, why the programs didn't rapidly restore confidence and growth. I'm not probably going to have time to go into all those in all the detail I want, but I'll cover some of the most important. Let me start with fiscal policy. Throughout this crisis, we faced a standard jibe, came very often from Larry Summers, that IMF stands for it's mostly fiscal. Well, that belief does tend to permeate the fund, and with good reason, because often a current account problem, and it's generally associated with domestic overheating, seems related to fiscal excess. But even if a current account problem wasn't caused by fiscal excess, question of how to deal with it may take you to fiscal policy anyway, because using monetary policy to deal with a current account problem by tightening monetary policy to slow the economy leads to an appreciation, and that doesn't do so well for improving the current account, and so you end up turning to fiscal policy. Now, table three, if we can find it, shows what happened to the fiscal adjustments made in the IMF programs. These are the numbers, and I hope you can read them, that describe what the fiscal targets were in the year of the before the program, then in the program, and then in subsequent reviews of the program. And these are targets, not actuals. In each of the Asian programs, there was some tightening of fiscal policy in the original program. And it was biggest in Thailand. And that was because when Thailand started, we thought we were dealing with just a regular crisis of the usual sort, including the fact that there was a very massive current account deficit at the time. When we calculated what was a desirable fiscal surplus or deficit to have. The calculation was based on some effort to see what sort of current account deficit you could sustain, and then you'd have to work back from the C plus I plus G equation to figure out what you needed for G and for NX to make that thing work. And often you'd have a current account target because the financing was limited and you couldn't just assume you could run any old current account target. And then we introduced an additional factor. We knew from the beginning of the Asian crisis that every one of these countries was going to have very large costs of dealing with its financial crisis. And so we added to the desired surplus an estimate not of the cost of the financial crisis, which is often 20% to 30% of GDP, but of the interest cost on the bonds that would be needed to finance the restructuring of the bank. So we added the interest times the expected increase in the debt so that the debt wouldn't run away. And that was how those calculations were made. But of course, those calculations are very sensitive, the C plus I plus G, to what is happening to aggregate demand. And it became clear in as the tie, I already talked about the Mexican program yesterday and the fact that there was a tightening between the first program presented by Mexico and the second, the March 9th program. So let's leave that one and talk about Thailand. It became clear, the Thai program started in August. It became clear in September and October that the economy was being hit much harder than we had anticipated. And the exchange rate had depreciated more than expected. And there was then a lively debate within the IMF and also with the board, and Gus was there at the time, on how to adjust fiscal policy. And there were sort of two thoughts. One was run it, ease it, because the cyclical situation is worse. And the other one was a fear that the markets would view fiscal easing as inappropriate at a time of rapid capital outflows when you didn't see how the country was going to finance itself. Now, we resolved that in favor with internally of letting the fiscal situation deteriorate somewhat. Now, the most interesting episode that I recall is Thailand, first review. We sent a mission to Thailand with instructions to ease on the fiscal targets. And they came back without having eased, which was somewhat bothersome. And when we asked why, they said they don't want to do it. First, there's a political complication involving the change in government. But secondly, they say they've always run balanced budgets, and they're not about to change. So there we were, unaccustomed as we were to urging governments to expand fiscally. That was what happened. Well, a bit later, the criticisms became even more intense, both inside and outside, and we eventually were able to move the countries and the institution to much larger fiscal deficits. And you see that particularly in the Indonesian case, we very rapidly encouraged the fiscal expansion. It took a bit longer in Korea, and it took some time, but not an incredibly long time, in Thailand. So that the fiscal position that was supported by the IMF changed very drastically over a period. Those reviews are typically 3 months apart, so you're looking at changes made within a period of 3 to 6 months. There's no question, or there may be some question, but I believe there was it was a mistake to tighten originally. But to mention an episode that really makes you realize how difficult this is, in January 1998, President Suharto presented the Indonesian budget. And the budget had a deficit that was, I think, 1.5% larger than in the IMF, in the agreement with the IMF. Now, in the meantime, all hell had broken loose in Indonesia. The currency had collapsed. And so we thought that was perfectly reasonable. Nobody asked us, and the markets went crazy. And the currency collapsed. Why? Well, we couldn't figure out whether they thought he was violating his agreement with the IMF or whether they just thought that was wrong. We said things, seems fair enough. But it just didn't work. And you sort of are dealing with markets where you really, it's very hard to predict what's going to happen when there are changes in programs. So that's not offered by way of excuse. That's offered by way of the difficulties of predicting how markets will react to what is happening. Well, what are the lessons that were drawn? Certainly, that fiscal correction may not be necessary in all balance of payments crises. If debt sustainability is not an issue, and if domestic demand is contracting, for instance, because investment has declined, as happened in the Asian countries, then it may be that without any fiscal contraction, and possibly with a fiscal expansion, you can get a current account that can be financed. The other thing I conclude is that actually this was turned around sufficiently fast. I don't think it did a great deal of damage, though it would have been better if it hadn't been necessary to turn it around in the first place. In both the Brazilian and the Russian cases, there was a fiscal tightening up front, and that was necessary, I believe, to deal with the debt situations. Now let me turn to monetary and exchange rate policies, and these are really more controversial in many ways, and the reason, part of the reason they're controversial is that I don't think they were wrong, and the critics do, so the controversy continues. The traditional way of defending an exchange rate, of defending a currency, is to raise the interest rate. And if capital is flowing out of a country, it doesn't make sense to make the currency less attractive to hold by reducing the rate of return for doing so, for holding it. So interest rates were used after the Asian devaluations in an effort to slow and reduce the extent of currency collapses. And this was done usually. There was some quantitative target for some monetary magnitude in the IMF supported program. And then some discussion on day-to-day management, because those monetary targets apply to particular dates, typically. Now, how do we calculate the monetary targets? We calculated them by making assumptions about what inflation was going to be and what it should be, about growth, and then applying a money demand function to figure out what the money growth rate should be to produce a reasonable inflation rate. And then on a day-to-day basis, we used to discuss with the authorities if the currency was going fast, what they should do on interest rates. Now, what was the criticism of this more or less standard way of doing business? It was that higher interest rates greatly exacerbated the recessions in Latin America, in Asia. And that we should have let the exchange rate go, had more depreciation, because it's costly to raise interest rates. They tended to create bankruptcies, and it was also argued that higher interest rates weakened the currency by so reducing growth prospects as to lead to a capital outflow. Now, that is not an impossibility, because it happens every other time that the European Central Bank raises interest rates. So that's a real possibility. Well, what did the IMF make the not follow that advice? We based our views on the belief, the fact, that both currency depreciation and high interest rates were damaging to business and consumers when there were so many dollar-denominated debts in the economy. And we also argued that interest rates would have to be raised only temporarily to stem the decline of the currency and could then be reduced, whereas allowing the exchange rate to depreciate would permanently raise the local currency value of dollar-denominated debts. And there was another factor. We are charged with being concerned about the impact of currency declines in one country on the currency of its neighbors. Well, that's all very nice at a general level, but were rates raised too high? In all the Asian cases, early in the programs, real interest rates were negative and quite low. So we were not convinced that they were that the nominal rates were that the real rates were too high. The one place where you see a very high, the two places where you see very high real rates, it's not Thailand, where at the highest they get up to 12%. It was Indonesia briefly. It's hard to know how to interpret those things because how you center those inflation rates is very important. And there seemed to be two spikes of real rates in Indonesia. And then in Korea, there was a brief period in late, in the first half of 1998 where the interest rate, the real rate, was for a short period quite high. Malaysia had lower rates before they imposed capital controls, and they managed to run with lower nominal rates and lower real rates, but they too raised real rates until the crisis, until the capital controls to defend the currency. Now, when is the normal prescription on interest rates inappropriate? That happens if raising interest rates leads to more depreciation, which is a Laffer curve of the exchange rate with respect to monetary tightening. Now, there must be levels of nominal and real interest rates so high that the currency would be strengthened by cutting them, but I don't believe it was reached in the Asian crisis. And during that period that you see very high nominal rates in Indonesia, there was a battle going on to get inflation under control. And the impact of very high inflation in Indonesia could have been devastating, in fact was, because the dollar borrowing in that country was very, very large, and it took a while to get that under control. Now, there have been a lot of studies examining the short-run relationship between interest rates and the exchange rate during the Asian and other crises, but as usually happens when you're trying to resolve a problem in real time, quote, the results of these studies are inconclusive and quite mixed. They don't find strong evidence for the traditional effect in which tightening of monetary policy strengthens the exchange rate, but they don't find consistent evidence for the perverse effect either. And you'd appreciate that the econometrics of getting endogenous policy timing right when you're anticipating in adjusting monetary policy is quite difficult. In both the Brazilian and the Russian programs, interest rates were high pre-devaluation, and as we said last time, ultimately the defenses failed. But in both cases, there were earlier successful high interest rate defenses of the currency. And I found it interesting looking back at the most cited example of how you can't defend a currency with high interest rates, namely Sweden's 500% interest rate in September 1992, that actually the 1992 defense worked. And it was only 2 months later that Sweden devalued in the face of a second interest rate shock. But I do not believe anybody should be sitting around holding interest rates in those levels for any length of time, because while you're doing that, you are going to damage the banking system and you are going to do damage to the corporate system. So my view on high currency, high interest rate defenses is they can succeed for a while, but only if it's perceived that there's light at the end of the tunnel. And that light means that there'll be something that will bring them down. In the Russian case, 1996, the light was the Yeltsin election victory. In Brazil, at the end of 1998, interest rates came down as the global crisis dissipated. One more thing. You can't make an interest rate defense succeed if the underlying macroeconomic situation isn't sustainable, for high interest rates worsen the fiscal situation. So the conditions under which you can do this are limited, but I believe they were present in the Asian case, and I believe that the fundamental belief that guided us, namely you wouldn't have to keep interest rates high for very long, and then you could stabilize the currency, was actually right. A quick point on what happens following a devaluation. Countries that have depended on a pegged rate find it almost impossible to contemplate life without the peg. And thus they seek, after their devaluation, some intermediate regime. Mexico, Brazil, and Russia each attempted to move to a band, an exchange rate band, following their devaluations. And Indonesia widens its band in July 1997. Not one of these bands lasted more than a few days. And they were just blown away by the capital movements that followed. And by the end, we were able to tell the people who were implementing the bans, it isn't going to last. There's absolutely overwhelming evidence it won't last. And they always say, it's different in our country. And everyone believes that. So we ended up with six floating rates, managed by and large, but floating nonetheless. After the collapse of a pegged rate regime, the central bank needs a basis for its monetary policy. And increasingly, and I believe with very good reason, countries with floating exchange rates have been putting in place inflation targeting regimes. This was regarded as a major innovation for the developing countries and the emerging market countries when it started, but is really working quite well in Mexico, in Brazil. It's not used in Russia. It is used less formally in Korea and Thailand. Now let me turn to the third controversial issue, structural policies. And this is figure 11. Figure 11 shows the number of structural conditions, that is non-setting of macroeconomic policy, money growth, fiscal, etc., in the different programs. And with the colors, what sectors the conditionality related to. What you see are a couple of striking facts. First, there was no structural conditionality in the Mexican program, period. It's right there at the end with nothing. There was much more structural conditionality in Indonesia and in Russia than in any of the other cases. Russia's was because it was in an extended fund facility, a structural a facility intended to deal with structural policies. Indonesia's was there because there's a lot to do in the financial sector, but there's also a lot to do in an area called other. And what was other? Other was things like the clove monopoly in Indonesia, or the plywood monopoly. Now, most of these non-traditional structural conditions were governance-related. And cloves, many of you know, but not all of you, are not only things that you put in your food, they're also things you put in your cigarettes in Indonesia. And so the clove monopoly actually matters and affects the cost of living of the poorer people. Now, what are the controversies about this conditionality hinge? What were they about? First was whether any structural conditionality should have been included in the programs. The second was on the nature of the financial sector conditionality. The third was the view that the programs neglected social sector conditionality, that we didn't pay attention to the social consequences. And fourth, that there was altogether too much conditionality. Now, those who argue there shouldn't have been any structural conditionality say that the Asian crises were in large part pure liquidity crises and they should have been resolved by providing lots of financing. And that would have resolved certainly the Korean case, possibly the Thai case. There is no question there was a sum of money that if you had it and given it to each of these countries, they'd have had much less of a crisis. But the numbers would have been very, very large. And further, given the view among market participants and officials before the crises broke out, that there were fundamental financial sector and corporate financing problems in the crisis countries, I believe the program had to deal with these difficulties if it was to succeed. I remember the discussions before the Indonesian program. They were all about the fact that the banking system was rotten. And I remember the discussions with the private sector and within the official sector on Korea, and they were all about how the corporate debt situation was untenable and how the financial system was very, very weak. So I believe you had to deal with that. Now, it's true there was no financial sector conditionality in the Mexican program, and the Mexican government dealt gradually, to be sure, with its financial sector. But that doesn't establish very much, and several senior Mexican officials with whom I've spoken believe that the financial sector reform was too slow in Mexico and should have been included in the program with the IMF. It was completed recently. I don't believe if there hadn't been this conditionality in Asia that they would have dealt with those problems at the same speed that they have. They haven't completed dealing with them. And the IMF has been moving now to narrow the scope of conditionality, and it has adopted the condition. Structural conditions should be included only if they are essential to achieving the macroeconomic goals of the program. I believe that the financial sector and the corporate sector conditionality in the Asian program meets that condition and should have been included in all cases. The question of the nature of the financial sector conditionality, which typically requires recapitalizing or closing bankrupt institutions, ensuring that equity holders take their losses, marking down assets and transferring them to other institutions, that is all a subject of great controversy, particularly over the 16 banks closed at the start of the program in Indonesia. Deposits in those banks were guaranteed up to an amount that covered small-scale depositors. Those 16 banks were what remained of an original list of 38, some of which were thought to be essentially broke, some of which were for one reason or another, and it was usually political, excluded from the 38. Initially, the closings went smoothly, but then a bank in which the president's son was a major shareholder was in effect allowed to reopen. Knowledge spread that there were another 20 banks waiting to be closed, and gradually deposits moved out of the banks regarded as unsafe into safe banks, particularly public banks. Now, we debated the extent of the guarantee within the IMF, where the debate was over the desire to prevent panic on one side, as with the knowledge, as against the moral hazard and fiscal costs that a blanket guarantee would create. And it was known that many of these banks that the assets in many of these banks were essentially worthless and that the loans had been corrupt loans. In retrospect, I believe that moral hazard should have been given less of a weight than it was in a blanket guarantee accepted, though I'm not sure that would have been acceptable at the time. And I now believe that in the balance of risks between creating a financial panic and the moral hazard and all that of blanket guarantees of deposits, that I would tend to favor the blanket guarantees. Let me mention, without going into it, that each program included social safety net measures. In Indonesia, the price of rice and cooking oil continued to be subsidized. In Thailand, there was provision for spending on public works to employ the poor. In Korea, there was provision to develop an unemployment insurance scheme. And we got it from both sides during the crisis. There were those who said we didn't know that there were social consequences and didn't do anything about it. I think those people didn't read the programs. And then there was another set of criticisms that we were trying to usurp the World Bank's role by including social safety net measures in these programs. Actually, all IMF programs include things that other institutions are going to do. It's the overall framework. And the World Bank was intended to do that. I won't discuss for length, for lack of time, whether there's too much structural conditionality in these programs. I'll just record my view, which is that in the Thai, Korean, Brazilian, and Russian program, the conditionality was entirely appropriate. That in the Indonesian program, where we had to do something to indicate to Indonesians and others, including those who were voting to, as they put it, provide our taxpayers' money to Indonesia, that we had to do something to indicate that the corruption was being addressed in the country, but that there was probably too much of that other conditionality in the Indonesian case. But just to make the point, this is like somebody once said to me, you know, you guys always talk about capital control, capital inflow controls, and whenever I hear you, you say, like Chile. Would you give me the next one, please? Here we say, like Indonesia. But Indonesia stands out as so different from the others that Indonesia is not typical of what happened in these programs. But I believe it was somewhat, but not greatly. Excessive. Let me briefly discuss the very tough question of private sector involvement and capital controls. Private sector involvement, in the way the language has developed, is defined as efforts to persuade private investors to maintain their exposure to the crisis country. And there were some such efforts in five of the six programs, but not in the Mexican case. In Thailand, the Japanese banks, who were the major creditors, were called in by Japanese authorities and asked to maintain their exposure to the country, and they agreed. Impressively, they managed to reduce their exposure from $38 billion in June 1997 to $26 billion a year later. $12 billion is a lot of money to flow out in a capital crisis, and to $18 billion 2 years later. So the Japanese banks pulled out $18 billion despite having been asked not to. The most impressive, the best known of the efforts of private sector involvement was the Korean case, where the banks were approached and agreed under some pressure to roll over to a restructuring of the interbank debts. And the big question that has been asked about Korea was, why did you, the IMF, wait? The program started on December the 4th. A lot of money flowed out until December the 24th. And at that stage, we and the G7 decided to approach the commercial banks and say that Korea was going to default unless the banks agreed to roll over interbank lines. Now, that all happened on Christmas Eve in the United States, but on Christmas morning in Europe, and I see one or two people who are awake at 3 a.m. on Christmas morning here shaking their heads. The British were more good-natured about being on the phone at that time of the day than their continental colleagues. Why didn't we go to the bank? Why didn't we go to the banks sooner? The fear was that if you approached the banks and told them they had to keep their money in Korea, they would do that and take it out somewhere else. That it was their exposure to emerging markets that they were controlling, and that hitting Korea would produce contagion, and that was a factor that was very much on our minds. And then there was one other factor, and this is new in debt crises, which is that central banks who are happy to apply moral suasion to their banks in the 1980s were much more squeamish about it in the 1990s. And they said, we are supposed to tell these guys to take care of the risks they run. We're supposed to tell them to keep their portfolios healthy. And then we've also got to go and tell them to keep their money in these crisis countries. And there's a conflict. And there may be many people who should tell them they have a duty, et cetera, to keep their money in those countries, but it's not really appropriate for the regulators to do that. And that's a view which is hard to disagree with, unless you are confident that what is really there is solely a collective action problem, in which if you can persuade them to keep their assets there, they'll be good assets, not bad assets. And if you are convinced of that, and in the Korean case we were pretty convinced, then I don't think there's a conflict. But if you're in a more dicey situation, and we are from time to time, it's harder to make that argument that it's a pure collective action situation. Well, there were also approaches to the banks in Indonesia. In Russia, there was an attempt to restructure the debt. And in Brazil, in the revised Brazil program, there was the Brazilian authorities got a voluntary rollover of their interbank lines, and that contributed to the success of the program. I will pass over the question of the size of programs. It's a very, very interesting question, but I do promise to put all this stuff, once I've checked it, to see if it makes sense, on your website as soon as possible. So it will be available. Let me just say a couple of things about the size of these programs. These programs were said to be $219 billion when I put them on the board yesterday. But some of the money in some of those programs was less real than some of the other money. And there were so-called second lines of defense which would be available in both Korea and Indonesia if they needed it and if they were doing the right thing. But as time went by, it became clear that the second line of defense might never be available, but always be held in reserves, and that was not very useful as the markets began to understand that. Second, I think the IMF paid a big price for trumpeting the large size of the programs. And it came as an enormous surprise to me, looking at the data, to discover that the amount the IMF lent in the 7 years from 1994 to 2000 was less relative to the global economy than it lent in the 1980s. Now, why was the a different impression that our role was so much larger in the most recent crisis? And the reason, there must be two reasons. One is this was much more dramatic than the Asian debt crisis, and that attracted a lot of attention. But also, I think that the size of the packages made them seem like they were much more massive interventions than they actually were. It's not that the $80 billion we lent is the right number. It was between the 218 and the 80. The total available funding to these countries was somewhere, I think, around $150 billion. So let me conclude now with comments on the crisis. Tomorrow will be about reform of the system and the fund. First, on the length of the crisis. We kept being asked during the Asian crisis, why is it taking so long to stabilize the situation compared with Mexico? And I used to answer, because your memory is incorrect. These were not long recessions. A typical recession in the United States lasts about a year. And in these countries, except in Indonesia, growth was restored within a year. And the speed with which the countries got back to financial markets was also impressive relative to previous international financial crises. Now, this is not because of the great wonders of what the IMF did, not only due to that. It's also because the global economy was in very good shape, and the United States was the engine of world growth throughout this period. And I think we should all shudder to think of what would have happened if these crises had taken place at a time of global recession, and those wonderful rebounds in exports and in growth hadn't happened. Now, what about the question, if you could do it all over again, what would you do differently? And whenever I hear this question, I'm reminded of my favorite Herblock cartoon, which is a picture of Richard Nixon sitting in a rocking chair on his porch with a reporter holding up a microphone and saying, obviously the retired Richard Nixon, Mr. President, if you had it to do all over again, what would you do differently? And the answer is, next time, no more Mr. Nice Guy. So there's the answer. Well, what should we have done differently? We should have pushed harder for exchange rate flexibility before the crisis and for more action to strengthen financial sectors, because we knew the financial sectors were weak, particularly in the Asian economies, and have been reported on by various IMF missions. We should have done that, but I'm not confident we would have succeeded, because policymakers who are doing extremely well are not much minded to listen to advice from complaining outsiders. Fiscal policy differently in the beginning of the Asian crisis. I wouldn't have changed the other macroeconomic policy recommendations. Structural conditionality. I think we should have emphasized even more the financial sector and corporate debt restructuring, and I would have applied the current test, macroeconomic relevance, more strictly, and that would have affected primarily Indonesia. Next problem, financing of a program. If you're going to have a program, you'd better tell people what the real financing is and make sure it's available when needed. And there shouldn't be any more second lines of defense or other financing whose delivery, the conditions of whose delivery is unclear. There should have been earlier efforts to ensure private sector involvement in the Asian countries. I think it would be desirable if countries took more ownership of their programs. It is very painful to have to agree a program with a country and then have the country sit around and do nothing to defend it. But I don't hold out much hope that we'll get a lot more ownership of programs. We have to keep trying. And I have a rule, which is that when a program is going badly, it's called an IMF program. And when it's going well, it's called the Brazilian or the Mexican or the Korean program. And that's just the way the newspapers do it, and there's not a whole lot you can do about that. Well, let me talk finally about a few personal reflections, and these are less cosmic. It is very hard to describe the state of shock of policymakers who are beset by a crisis that has destroyed their entire policy framework. I know you had a chancellor who sang in the bath, but most of them don't react that way. The people affected start by blaming everything and everyone but themselves. They resent the need to call on outside help, and they find it very difficult to think realistically. And it's a bit later that the serious policymakers get down to work, but there is a period of shock. And it's in that period that it's very difficult to get realistic growth assumptions or forecasts into a program. I was told by one policymaker with whom I said, you'll probably have zero growth next year. which, by the way, was optimistic. He said, "My country cannot accept less than four." You know, that is the state of mind, as if it's something you can control. Third point, restoring confidence is very difficult and it's time-consuming. And that, to go back to the first point, it's partly because at the start of the crisis, the country usually regards itself as the victim, while everyone else is blaming it for what has happened. And I several times sat in the board of the IMF listening to the representative of a country explain to 23 skeptical colleagues that policy was about perfect before the crisis, and it was just a series of unfortunate accidents that led to the request for a loan. Now that puts us all in a very difficult position. Us all is the management and the staff and the executive board of the IMF. We're trying to help the country recover from a crisis, and so we're not about to go out and criticize it in public. And that's a tough, so then you tend to become an apologist, explaining things away. It's very hard to strike the right balance to avoid saying things that are not true while not undermining the program that you're trying to help succeed. Fifth point, it's very difficult to fight the markets. I've often thought that the markets were wrong in their appraisals of countries, and I think that now about one or two. And I've often thought as a country struggled with skeptical markets about multiple equilibria, and that if we could only be in the good equilibrium, the country's policies would be perfectly adequate to deal with the crisis. But there's no amount of saying that that is going to change the fact that the markets are there and that that's the reality that you have to deal with. And so you deal with it. You try to explain what you're doing and why the situation is better than they think and so forth, but it's difficult. Sixth point. There are major benefits to having an IMF. It is far more acceptable for a country that is in a crisis to have to deal with an organization of which it is a member and in which it has rights and privileges, including the right to borrow if it gets into a crisis, and an organization which represents the entire international community, than to have to deal with a series of individual countries and with a series of agreements with separate countries. And finally, in each crisis, I remembered the words of the former managing director, I think he was there when Gus was there, Michel Kamdasu, who summoned us to meet with him very early in the morning in his office after the United States' $40 billion support program for Mexico failed to receive congressional support. And he said, as we arrived, "Gentlemen, this is a crisis. And in a crisis, you keep calm." Thank you. Okay, we do questions. There are mics circulating and they can come from anywhere. Down here, please.
A country cannot resume sustained growth if the financial system is not in a healthy condition. That's the case for Turkey as well. What do you think Turkish authorities should do to clean up the banking system? Should all the remaining private banks, troubled private banks, be nationalized immediately, or should the government inject public funds to strengthen the capital of those banks?
The Turkey program and the Japan program, which about which a question was asked yesterday, are similar. I'm not going to go into details in Turkey, but since you've raised the question, let me just say that a great deal has been done in cleaning up the Turkish financial system and dealing with a very weak banking system, but I don't want to go into more detail that. I don't want to go into detail on that. And somewhere in the text, you'll see a footnote that says, I avoid discussing the Turkish and Argentine crises so I don't have to speak about current events. Next one up there, if you can get him the mic. Yeah.
You started off quoting Michel Camdessou about the first crisis of the 21st century. Given Argentina and Turkey going through crises now, I mean, do you now believe that we've seen the end of that type of crisis? Is there something that's fundamentally changed in all of these countries, that the current account-driven crisis is coming to an end, that we have to change our thinking now, that we have to look to something else? Has this largely been resolved in some way or another, or working its way through the system?
We haven't got rid of crises driven by adverse debt dynamics, and exchange rate regime doesn't change the fact that a country that whose debts are too large is going to have a crisis of some sort. But because so many countries have moved to flexible exchange rates, so many emerging market countries have, I believe the likelihood of crises of the type that I've been discussing is much smaller than it used to be for emerging market countries. Will something show up that will be a surprise? It's guaranteed, but unfortunately I don't know what it is. Up there.
Okay, two questions. Can you comment on the transparency calls by Senator Bernard Sanders? Maybe you know him quite well, because he's been bugging the IMF for quite some time. Do you think there might be some changes in terms of the transparency of how the IMF works and the reports of the board of directors? And then the second question is, can you be more specific on the private sector involvement in Asia? I mean, what specific programs do you have in mind that the IMF could have done?
Yeah. First on Congressman Sanders, there really has been a remarkable change in the extent to which, in the extent of transparency in the IMF, and the amount of documentation that is now available is really quite enormous, and you can take a look at it on our website. This year we got agreement of the Executive Board to publish the staff's reports on IMF-supported programs. So now not only is the agreement in the IMF published, but also what it is that the IMF staff tells the board about those. What is left that is not published is very little. I think deliberations of the Executive Board are not published verbatim, but there's a summing up that is published very quickly. So Bernie Sanders was pushing on an open door on that issue with regard to the management of the IMF and with regard to large parts of the Executive Board, including the US and the UK, very early on. And it was just a matter of persuading others. And I thought that transition was actually one of the examples of the IMF at its best, because the developing countries didn't want to do it initially, and there were experiments, and there was never a stage at which anybody was forced to agree with this. But over a period of 5 or 6 years, we managed to bring everybody along by making it voluntary, whether you publish reports on your own country. And that's worked very well. On private sector involvement, I think there are three things that could have been tried. One was to go a bit sooner in the Korean case, which would have saved some capital outflows. The second was that the agreement in Thailand should have been a bit broader and should have been monitored better. And then in Indonesia, that one was the hardest, because you're dealing with private sector debts, not primarily banking debts. A scheme was put in place to deal with those debts, which was similar to a scheme that had been used in Mexico in the 1990s, but it took a long time to negotiate an agreement. I'm not sure that you could have got much done in the Indonesian case, but it might have been desirable to start a little bit earlier rather than in January. when it did start. It took 6 months to negotiate, so I don't think it would have made a heck of a lot of difference, but could have started earlier. Over there.
In your presentation tonight, you have referred to contagion, and one of your colleagues at the IMF recently, well, former colleagues, recently said contagion, said he didn't predict any contagion in the sense of the words, in the sense of the meaning used in the 1990s. Do you agree with such views, looking at the current market conditions and everything else?
I'm not sure what he meant by that, so and I'm not sure who said it, but so I can't. I can't comment. There are some indications at the moment that contagion looks to be less in the present environment than it was in the 1990s. Correlations between spreads and movements in spreads are lower than they were. What happens in an extreme event is difficult to foretell. Nobody, I think, predicted what would happen in the Russian case. And so these are things which you can speculate about beforehand. I think whatever he might have meant, there is an interpretation that's consistent with that. But it's hard to be confident about these things. Over there, please. Somebody, you going to throw it? Why don't you get the mic over there? And could we bring a mic down here as well, please? Yep.
Do you agree with Paul Krugman's pronouncement back in the middle of the 1990s that none of the existing currency crisis models in the academic literature offered an accurate description of what was happening, particularly in the Asian crises? And also, were there any either published papers or working papers circulating from academics working outside the IMF that you or your colleagues found particularly useful or that shaped your policy responses at all?
I think there were a variety. I think there were elements in the Asian crisis that were not consistent with the pre-existing models, but I thought that a lot of that some of what we saw was consistent with a second or at least a third generation model. So it's very dangerous to disagree with Paul, but I thought we were getting some enlightenment from those models as we thought about it. Yeah, we read everything very intensively. We probably read more frequently the op-ed pages of the major newspapers than the scientific papers, but I'm sure the research department and I also looked at the papers that were coming out, and there was a great deal going on trying to explain contagion, trying to explain the depths of the crisis, trying to explain how a weak financial sector fed into the generation of a crisis and its extent that we were looking at. But please don't ask me to name a specific reference. I've got a big box full of them, and I can show them to you one day. Yeah.
How do you explain that in all these crises which we've been discussing, creditors were prepared to finance these processes in spite of the fact that it must have been quite evident that in many ways the situations were unsustainable, and this financing took place over long periods and very large amounts?
Yeah, you see, I think you only know it's unsustainable ex post in some of these cases. And I was asked yesterday how come the Mexicans didn't see that there was a crisis coming, and there were reasons. They had large-scale foreign direct investment. NAFTA had just taken place. There'd been a lot of structural reform. You could tell the story that this was a very good investment. And so it wasn't that obvious, and it was that crisis was there, and that was bound to be a crisis. It was obvious to Rudy Dornbusch and others, but not to everyone by any means. In the Asian crisis countries, I really think that people did believe that that trees grow to the sky, that that success was bound to go on forever, or at least for a very long time. It was interesting because even in the Korean case, it was actually, Korea came awfully close to participating in the debt crisis in the 1980s. So if people had been looking closely, they would have realized that it was less obvious than it seemed. You know, but there were these Korean banks. I forget what the size of Korea was in the global economy, but it's a big economy. Strong public finances, and they were lending to Korean banks, which had implicit government guarantees. So it wasn't that obvious that Korea was going to collapse. Thailand was the one, but the capital outflows began a bit earlier than the crisis, and they were under pressure for some time. So I don't want to say that there were no foolish investments made. I don't want to say that there were people who were persuading themselves that there were much better reasons for doing things than they actually were for doing them. But they could tell a story in many of those cases. So I can't say any more than that. Last two, Richard, and then one more.
I can't get Marcus Miller to ask the question, so I'll ask it. What's your comment on the Malaysian handling of their crisis compared with these ones on the board?
Yeah. You know, the Malaysian handling of the crisis was essentially identical to that of the other countries until the day they imposed capital controls. And if you look at the fiscal policy, at what they are trying to do in restructuring, there was no major difference. The only thing was that they managed to keep interest rates lower, and that strikes me as not a huge surprise because they had much smaller external debts and their corporate sector was much less leveraged than the rest. They had the soundest economy in Southeast Asia to begin with. It only started getting different with the capital controls, and at that point I thought the capital controls are being imposed in order to slow down some of the restructuring. But actually, they kept going on the restructuring, particularly in the banking system. So that I think they handled it reasonably well. They didn't come out of it much better. But that illusion is everywhere. If you look at what happened to them, at what happened to GDP, at what happened to the exchange rate, what happened to the stock market and the current account, it's not a very different story. And they started in a better position. So that's my comment on that one. But the emotion around the Malaysian case is very, very strong. And it's very hard to get people to take an objective look at it. And quite possibly I'm not fully objective either. There were also political events going on in Malaysia that tended to color some people's view of capital controls. There was somebody in the back there.
Well, you mentioned yesterday one reference to the quantity of IMF resources. Now, how far was this a consideration in your mind in dealing with all of these crises in the 1990s? Not so much, perhaps, in the amount of assistance that you gave, but in the form that the assistance took.
It was very much a concern until the quota increase took place in October 1998. We were running out of money, and as the Brazilian crisis mounted, and you could paint scenarios in which that wasn't the end of the story, you could see that the IMF wouldn't have money. And that was pretty frightening, and it frightened the Congress, I think, as well. And then we did get the capital increase. I think we used the GAB, the General Agreement to Borrow, in, I think, the Korean crisis, if I'm right, but certainly one of those crises, We wouldn't have had to do that if we'd had enough of our own money. We did part of the reason in the written text, there's a long discussion of the role of bilateral financing. There's a lot of bilateral financing. I think the fundamental reason for it was you needed more money than the IMF had during parts of that that crisis. But there's more to the issue of bilateral financing than just whether the IMF should whether the IMF has enough money. Anyway, the short answer is yes, it was a constraint.
Could I put in three final requests? First of all, could you please remain seated until Stan has left the platform? I'm asked by the security people to tell you that. Secondly, the denouement is same place, same time tomorrow. So for those who want to hear Act 3 of this session, please come again tomorrow. And finally, could you please join me in expressing your thanks to Stan for his transparency.